from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
I would say the two constitutions that are increasingly at war in our politics are the original constitution, which I call the Founders' Constitution, and the Liberals' Constitution, which they like to call the Living Constitution.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Charles Kessler. We'll talk with him later on today's program about his brand new book, Crisis of the Two Constitutions, The Rise, Decline, and Recovery of American Greatness. First up, we talk with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale College, about Frederick Douglass, the journalist. We do so because Frederick Douglass celebrated his birthday on February 14th. He also died February 20th of 1895. At the age of 77. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Scott.
Talking today about Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, the journalist. Frederick Douglass, people know as an abolitionist, but he was also a journalist, and that's where we come in today. Douglass was born into slavery, John. How did he become prominent?
Well, he's best known, of course, as you say, as an abolitionist. He was a great orator. He's a terrific speaker. We don't have any recordings of him, obviously. You can't go look up a Douglass speech on YouTube. We have contemporary accounts of this. We know he was just a spellbinding orator. How did he come to his education? As you say, he's born into slavery. He had an owner at one point whose wife actually began to teach him to read and write, and then she stopped. But she gave him just enough information so that he could go and educate himself. And he snuck around with books, and they had these readers that people would use in the 19th century, and Frederick Douglass had one. And he would go talk to other kids. He's about 12 years old, and he's doing this. Talk to other children. Can you help me out with this word? What does this mean? And so on. And so there was a heavily self-taught element to this. So he learned to read and write, and, of course, there's a real native intelligence at work here with Frederick Douglass. And he learns to read and write and learns to do it really, really well. Eventually, he escapes his bondage and moves into the North, and he becomes this prominent abolitionist, a great speaker. But of course, one of the best ways to reach people in those days was through the printed word. And so he had his own newspaper that was called the North Star, named obviously after the star in the sky that does not move. And if you're a runaway slave and you wonder which direction should I go, you know, follow that star. And if you follow long enough, you'll get to freedom in the North. His newspaper was called the North Star for many years. And he would print his abolitionist ideas. He would cover abolitionist happenings and so on. And eventually he had several thousand subscribers, most of them white, probably almost all of them white, and became a real voice for black freedom in the United States.
What do we know about Douglass as a publisher, as an editor? What was he like?
Well, he was a stickler for accuracy. And that's in part because he was constantly criticized as being a kind of figurehead. And people would say, there's no way a black man possibly could put out a newspaper. And people would visit his newspaper office hoping to find a bunch of white people who are actually putting together the paper because a black man couldn't do it, right? Well, Douglass actually did it. He spent many hours in his print shop working on this newspaper, putting it together. And he thought it was important that a black man actually do this, that he not be a figurehead, that he be actually the writer and producer and editor and publisher and all of that of his newspaper. So he did those things, and he was a real stickler for things like typos, because he thought every time if he spelt a word incorrectly, if there was just a typo in his newspaper, and of course anybody who's been involved in journalism knows you're going to have typos, you're going to have little mistakes like this constantly. You fix them, you correct them when you have to, all that kind of stuff. But Douglass thought every time there's a typo, every time there's a little error, people are going to use this as quote-unquote evidence of black inferiority. And so it's like the old Jackie Robinson rule, mm-hmm. that, you know, when Jackie Robinson broke into Major League Baseball, he couldn't be just an ordinary baseball player. He had to be a superstar. He had to be one of the very best. And if you could do that, then later on you could have other black baseball players who were ordinary. But the first one had to be excellent. And so Frederick Douglass just wanted to be excellent in everything he did. And so he worked very hard on this newspaper. And as I say, he wanted to get every little thing right.
Talking with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale College, about Frederick Douglass, the journalist. John, how would you compare his influence as an orator to his influence as a writer publisher at that time?
Well, he was a terrific orator, and that's how he first came to attention. In fact, William Lloyd Garrison, the famous abolitionist who also had a newspaper called The Liberator, heard Frederick Douglass speak. And that's where he came to his attention. He thought, this guy's special, and let's have him, you know, bring him into our movement, have him write for my newspaper, which Douglass did. And so Douglass remained an orator for a long time. He also knew that he could really extend his reach with the printed word. And in fact, his audience would be much larger if he printed a newspaper that went out to thousands and thousands of people. You give a speech to, you know, get a few hundred people, that's awesome, right? But you know, the words vanish in the air. So newspaper made a big difference. He did that. Eventually, during the Civil War, he actually gave up his newspaper because he recognized, when I give a speech, other people will write about it. So he knew that he eventually became so popular and so good at this that he could give up the newspaper, just give the speeches, and then other people would do the printing journalistic work that he himself initially had done.
We sit here on the campus of Hillsdale College in Michigan, where Frederick Douglass made a couple of visits during his life, once during the Civil War, once toward the end of his life. Why was he here at Hillsdale?
Hillsdale College was a prominent abolitionist college that was influential in the founding of the Republican Party in the 1850s, and Frederick Douglass wanted to visit. So he came by here during the Civil War, made a stop in Hillsdale, spoke at the college chapel. He was on a speaking tour at the time. He also sat for a photograph in Hillsdale, and it's one of the most famous images of him. Actually, the photo was taken in Hillsdale, and then we reproduced widely, and the college actually owns the original, which is really neat. And so we have this close connection to him. He was actually on our campus speaking to our students way back when, and now there's this terrific statue of him. There's a nifty story about the second visit, which came in the late 1880s. He died in 1895, so this is well after the Civil War, and it's toward the end of his life. His great cause of abolition, he had prevailed in that cause, and of course there were other problems and challenges before him, but in the great movement and cause of his life, he had prevailed. But anyway, he came back here in the 1880s, and the college had forgotten this. And I had a student in journalism who was fond of looking at old copies of the campus newspaper. And she would look at them online, maybe microfilm, but she would just go look at really old copies of the campus newspaper, searching for story ideas. And, you know, what were things like way back when? How weird was student life, you know, in the 19th century, this sort of thing. And she produced a lot of good journalism doing that. As she was doing this, she discovered this record of Douglass having come back in the late 1880s, and as I say, the college had no institutional memory of it. It was our college's historian didn't know about it, but there it was, the evidence that he had come back. He actually spoke in town at a roller skating rink of all things, but it was partly a college event. And she wrote about it. It was a big, you know, front page story when we did it. You know, Frederick Douglass came twice to Hillsdale College. And so we have this close connection. And I love the fact that one of our student journalists discovered this about, you know, one of America's great journalists.
John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, talking Frederick Douglass, the journalist. John, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Charles Kessler, author of the brand new book, Crisis of the Two Constitutions, The Rise, Decline, and Recovery of American Greatness. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello and welcome to our brand new affiliate, WIBX 950 AM in Utica, New York. Thanks for listening to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined by Dr. Charles Kessler, editor of the Claremont Review of Books, senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, and professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. His brand new book is out now, Crisis of the Two Constitutions, The Rise, Decline, and Recovery of American Greatness. Dr. Kessler, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I've read your book. It is tremendous. I guess we need to start by asking you exactly what you mean by two constitutions. Most of us, of course, know one constitution. What do you mean by two constitutions? How would you define the difference?
Well, I'm pointing to the lingering presence and the stubborn presence of increasing political polarization in America. It's reached the point where the tradition of the loyal opposition is fading away. That was the tradition which said, look, we have two political parties, but we have one constitution. And the loyalty to the constitution is a higher loyalty. It trumps our loyalty to our individual political ideologies or parties. And that was the basis for, you know, many generations of the American political settlement. Increasingly, I think we don't have those circumstances anymore. What separates us is more important than what joins us together. And so instead of a tradition of loyal opposition, ours is a tradition of resistance, you know, with a capital R. That is that whichever party is in power regards the other party as illegitimate. And whichever party is out of power regards the party that's in power as illegitimate. And this has been sort of our politics for at least 20 years, and I think even longer than that if you look at it carefully. And so I characterize this dispute as not one about, how to interpret the common constitution, but really which constitution to interpret. And I think it's not a metaphor merely to say that we are moving towards a country which has, you know, one nation and two constitutions, which is not a good situation to be in. And I would say the two constitutions that are increasingly at war in our politics are the original constitution, which I call the Founders' Constitution, and the Liberals' Constitution, or the Progressive Constitution, which they like to call the Living Constitution.
And where do we see this fight playing out? How do we see those competing or opposing cultures staking out ground?
Well, you can see it in many areas, but in general, it's a disagreement about what ought to be in our Constitution, what ought to be constitutional for us. Just 4 years ago in 2016, the Democratic Party, in its platform, this was when Hillary Clinton was running, adopted a plank calling for the amendment of the First Amendment. Amending the First Amendment to reduce its coverage so that more speech would escape the zone of freedom that the First Amendment sets out. More speech would be restricted, more political spending would be restricted by political categories. We have a debate about the First Amendment. We have a debate about the Second Amendment. Do we need it? What is it for? Those are the kinds of hot-button issues that increasingly divide the two constitutions, divide our images of what the two constitutions are.
Charles Kessler with us. His new book, Crisis of the Two Constitutions, is available now. In Chapter 5, you say that education and politics are inseparable. In what way do you mean that?
Well, it's all of the great books of political philosophy. The greatest of them are certainly books of education, Plato's Republic, Rousseau's Emile, Aristotle's Politics, and many others. And that's because politics, in its most capacious sense, is about making citizens. What kind of human being should be an American? What are the opinions about justice and fairness that should characterize an American? What are the habits? And those things, habits, opinions, beliefs, are shaped by education in the formal sense of schooling, but also by games, habits, songs, the whole culture of a country. And in that sense, politics, properly understood or understood from the highest point of view, is really about education, making a certain kind of citizen, making an American. And the founders thought very long and hard about this because they were forced to be in a position to make their own constitution mm-hmm. anew, and of course all their own laws. And so they had to, they looked at politics not simply as a part of social life, but as in a way the most formative part of social life, the sort that would give a form, a mold to Americanism and to American civilization afterward. That sense, that noble sense of what politics is about, is what I mean when I say politics and education are inseparable.
And further into the book, how does American citizenship differ from multicultural citizenship? You discuss both. And is there a way to redeem American citizenship?
Yes. Well, the sort of classic criticism of American citizenship is that it has been limited, that there are in-groups as opposed to out-groups, and that chattel slaves, of course, being the most infamous of the out-groups, but one could also argue to some extent about the status of women and other groups and minority, and in the case of women, majority groups in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And the multicultural critique seizes on those facts and it denies the interpretation that statesmen like Lincoln and others brought to those facts, and instead says that the whole confecture of American citizenship is rotten. It's to translate this into modern, the most modern terminology, it's white supremacy, or it's racist all the way down. And the only way to cure it of this mortal ill is essentially to transform it into a different thing, which is what thinkers on the left sometimes call multicultural citizenship, which is a citizenship that, on the one hand, is supposed to treat every culture equally, but on the other hand, is dead set against a comprehensive citizenship, dead set against traditional citizenship of the sort I was just speaking about, that's designed to sort of form character and opinions.
We'll pause right there. More in just a moment with Dr. Charles Kessler, his new book, Crisis of the Two Constitutions. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hey, guys, I'm Bob the Drop. Welcome to my podcast. Do you like water? If you do, you're going to love me. I'm pure and simple. I'm talking refreshing. Yeah. Spent 500 years in a glacier. The boy was that cold. I never was and never will be tap water. Nope. Bottled at the source, the base of Mount Shasta. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. You can try me by calling 1-800-922-6227. Mount Shasta Spring Water.
It's never too late to achieve your dream, to turn a skill into a career. At Shasta College, we have late start classes right now and online classes where the commute from the couch to the class has never been easier. We're also offering 8-week compressed classes, same units, half the time. Now is the right time to upskill or reskill for high-demand jobs employers are hiring for. Find out more. Visit ShastaCollege.edu today.
Hi, I'm Arielle Winter. If you're anything like me, your pets are not only your best friends, they're part of your family. American Humane, which has been rescuing animals like Cleo here for more than 100 years, has life-saving tips that can make a big difference in a disaster. When disaster strikes, you want to protect your whole family, including your pets. To help keep your family safe and help our best friends in their worst times, find tips at AmericanHumane.org.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
These are unprecedented times. Challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency childcare, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. For more information about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for alumni, or friends of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu. We've been talking with Charles Kessler. His brand new book is Crisis of the Two Constitutions, The Rise, Decline, and Recovery of American Greatness. You mentioned earlier in the interview that what separates us is becoming more important than what brings us together. And to that point, if we can't agree on what American citizenship looks like, that seems a very worrying trend for the future.
Yes, I mean, I don't think it's inevitable that our disagreements will grow and become acute. They are growing, and they are becoming acute, but it doesn't necessarily have to go on like this forever or to a breaking point. However, there are certainly discouraging tendencies in American politics along these lines. Now, there are, I'm encouraged by some facts from the recent election. For example, in the 2020 election in California, a heavily Democratic state, which gave to Joe Biden, 70-some percent of its popular vote, at the same time, the voters, that same very Democratic, very liberal electorate, refused to repeal Prop 209.
Mm-hmm.
Prop 209 was passed a generation ago in a popular initiative, and it was designed to forbid the use of racial discrimination in university admissions, government hiring in California, and in a few other categories. So this was an attempt to repeal the prohibition against the use of race. It was an attempt to legitimize racial quotas and discrimination in admissions and hiring. So this was the next step in the identity politics agenda. And the people, the good news is, the people of California voted it down. And they voted it down pretty overwhelmingly by about 11%, which is more than twice the margin that the original Prop 209 had a generation ago when it won. So this is encouraging insofar as it suggests that even modern progressive democratic liberals may see some stopping point. They may see that that there's a line they may not want to cross in the legitimization of racial, gender, and other kinds of group discrimination as a formal part of American politics. And if that's true, that is a hopeful sign, because it shows you that the extreme left of the Democratic Party is rapidly isolating itself, or suggests at least that they're rapidly isolating themselves from their own base.
Charles Kessler is with us. The new book, Crisis of the Two Constitutions, The Rise, Decline, and Recovery of American Greatness. You spend some time in the book discussing the old new left and the new left. How would you describe the differences, and should we be concerned about that change?
It is a concerning change. The old new left was the left of the SDS, the Black Panthers, and others in the sort of classic 1960s, the anti-Vietnam War left, which started out inspired by the civil rights movement, but eventually in the course of the 1960s would abandon that nonviolent and even, you might say, religious orientation in favor of a much more Marxist and even nihilist orientation, you know, and endorsing violence, endorsing the Weatherman's bombing campaign against police around the country, and things like that. In a way, we're still trapped in the 60s in our politics. But that was the old new left. The new left is the current identitarian left, to use that ugly word, which is so powerful on campuses today, but also in the streets of cities like Portland and Seattle, in the Black Lives Matter and Antifa and other such sort of quasi, militia movements. The new left is, the old new left was idealistic. It wanted to convert the country to its ways of thinking. It wanted to change the world to make it a better place. And this was part of, you know, a kind of romantic phase in American political life on campus and elsewhere in the early to mid 1960s. The new left is not idealistic at all. It expects every race, every ethnicity, every gender to assert itself, to follow its self-interest, and to attempt to win, to secure power over others. This is a much more a darker new left. It's not idealistic. It is in its own mind extremely realistic, and offers no hope of redemption or of idealistic transformation. Its only hope is for victory over its enemies.
Charles, how much of this from the left starts on college campuses, or at least most college campuses around the country? What does it say about what's happening there today?
One doesn't really know what campus life is like, because most places, most colleges, unlike Hillsdale, are shut down, and students have not been there because of the COVID year.
Mm-hmm.
But they will come back eventually, and we will be reintroduced to campus politics probably in the fall of this year. And there we will discover, I think, if it picks up where it left off, that it is, that cancel culture, political correctness, harsh restrictions on speech and behavior are still the norm and are the preferred method of left-wing campus forces in advancing their agendas.
Charles, have conservatives been less than successful in reviving the Founders' Constitution? And if you think so, how might tactics change to make a difference?
That's a very good question. I think, obviously, if you look at the 20th century, it really is a liberal century. Liberalism marched across America and conquered the high ground of American politics, beginning in the progressive decade at the start of the 20th century, but then reaching full flower in the New Deal and in the 60s and the Great Society period. Conservatism doesn't really get its innings, doesn't start winning until 1980 and Ronald Reagan's election and 1994 and Newt Gingrich's triumph in the House of Representatives, returning it after 40 years, I mean an unprecedentedly long period under Democratic control, returning it finally in 1994 to the Republicans. 1980, 1994, the 20th century is almost over. That's why if you look at the 20th century as a whole, I think you could defend it as sort of the liberal century, the century that liberalism emerged in our politics and conquered it, at least temporarily, and changed it in many important ways. So conservatism has been fighting a rear guard action, a recovery action, to try to gain back the ground that it lost. You can locate it in a way in the universities. I mean, the change in the conception of America, the turn against American principles, founding principles, really is the work of the liberal academy in the course of the 20th century. My book is about that to a large degree. But conservatives have not figured out how to solve that problem.
Charles Kessler, editor at the Claremont Review of Books and senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, also professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. And again, the brand new book is out now, Crisis of the Two Constitutions, The Rise, Decline, and Recovery of American Greatness. Charles, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott. Great fun.
Up next, Dr. Ben Beyer from Hillsdale's Education Department begins an occasional series on definition. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's never too late to achieve your dream, to turn a skill into a career. At Shasta College, we have late start classes right now and online classes where the commute from the couch to the class has never been easier. We're also offering 8-week compressed classes, same units, half the time. Now is the right time to upskill or reskill for high-demand jobs employers are hiring for. Find out more. Visit ShastaCollege.edu today.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 and 1460 AM.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Did you know that the City of Reading has started licensing commercial cannabis activities within the city limits? Synergy is the first of the city's approved retailers to obtain licensure, bringing to the Reading area the most experienced retailer in the North State. They will ensure that your visit is both professional and comfortable. Access is simple and discreet. Synergy has a private 25-space parking lot at the back of the building. Synergy is located at 345 Hempstead Drive, Reading.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the show. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education at Hillsdale College. Dr. Beyer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Starting a series, an occasional series this week, on definition. And so where should we start when we talk about definition?
Well, I mean, I think I'd have to give some sort of account or defense of why people ought to care, because...
That's not a bad way to start a conversation.
Sounds like a rather egg-headed thing that somebody might think about in an ivory tower, but how does it matter to everyone? But I actually think that definition matters quite a lot to our everyday life, because I'm sure we've all had an experience where we're in a conversation, maybe a heated one, you know, at Thanksgiving or in the public square, or who knows, and suddenly you realize that you've been, you know, wildly misunderstood, or that you're talking past the person, and and usually it comes down to the fact that you're using the same word in a slightly different manner. And so if you can get that pinned down, it can really help you know, understand another person, have a dialogue, maybe even come to a meeting of the minds sometimes. So that seems like the general sort of, like, all of us as users of language, you know, who are seeking after truth or trying to persuade other people, it's handy. Then maybe just to get a teeny bit more technical, you know, so I'm involved in the classical education movement, in liberal higher education. Right there are some things that need definition. Liberal education, classical education, kind of squishy words that could use some defining, but not right now. But, you know, classical education holds out study of the seven liberal arts, one of which is logic. Mm-hmm. And so logic, Aristotelian logic, traditional logic, has an important spot within its study for definition. So there's the idea that definition is not just going to, you know, help us with our conversations, but it's actually going to liberate us. It's gonna free us to think more clearly, to actualize who we are as human beings. And then related to this, we might say, you know, how the philosopher thinks about definition.
Mm-hmm.
So the philosopher, of course, really appreciates being really precise when trying to speak about the way things are. But definition for the philosopher isn't just a tool, but it's an object of study, because, you know, in the philosophy of Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, and others, when they go and look at the human mind and are trying to come to understand the human mind, they argue ultimately that there's three actions or operations of the human mind that distinguish it from other animals that also have many cognitive functions. And so the one act that's relevant here is sometimes called simple apprehension. So this happens with all of us all the time, where we have that moment where we go from, you know, you have a sense impression of this tree, that tree, another tree, and then you hold those things in your memory, the images or the ideas of them. The moment at which you sort of abstract away and have sort of a sense of tree-ness common to all trees, that's simple apprehension. And so the philosopher wants to study that. And then, right, what definition can do for the philosopher, and perhaps for all of us, is it can move us from that apprehension, which is rough and ready, like we kind of know what a tree is, but we couldn't really say it.
Mm-hmm.
But then we can move from apprehension to comprehension and actually express what a tree is with a strong definition. So every man, the philosopher, and classical education, we all need definition.
Let's get kind of really inside ourselves here. How do we define definition? What is a definition?
Well, poorly is how we define definition. You know, I think a place to begin is a good place to begin almost anything is Socrates. And Plato's Socrates, in the dialogue called the Meno, Socrates and Meno are speaking and trying to define shape and color. They're having a hard time. Meno is especially having a hard time, and Socrates is correcting him. But in the process of trying to get to some good definitions, which they never quite get there, Socrates gives us, I think, a good starter for defining definition. He comes to say, a good definition is going to account for every instance of a thing, only that thing, always. So that's kind of a three-part standard to test a definition. Does this account for every tree, only trees, all the time? Then we're in a good spot. And the Greek word that Plato uses there is interesting too. It's the word from which we get the English horizon, and it probably literally translates as boundary, right? So you're fencing in, right, every instance of a tree and only trees to kind of get at the essence or the nature of what it is. But then the thing that happens as people try to define, they discover there's lots of different types of definition, different strategies for defining. And sometimes we'll have an object we wish to define, and we can't quite say of it, you know, that which counts for every instance and only instances. And so, right, the definition of Socrates doesn't work in every case. Mm-hmm. So to define definition, we'd start having all these caveats, like, well, some definitions are adequate and some aren't. And that's really what I think in the other instances of this series, what we can do is we can look at different types of definition and their strengths and their weaknesses, all ultimately in view of where we began, you know, so that we can just in our lives be a little bit more careful with words and better understand things.
Talking with Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education here at Hillsdale College, about definition. In our future segments, we'll dive deeper. Do we want to lay out some types of definition here as we begin?
I think that'd be great. So, you know, there's a group of definitions we might call definitions that have to do with words rather than things. Sometimes they're called non-logical definitions. This includes when you define from synonym or metaphor or etymology or a related one, which kind of has to do with words, kind of doesn't, is when you define negatively what a thing isn't. So I think we should begin there because we're all most familiar with that, and those are helpful. But then we can turn to what are sometimes called logical definitions. And of those, there are four different types. And the weakest of those four is defining by accident, and then by property. And so we can talk about those two that don't quite get at the very heart of what a thing is. And then the final two logical definitions are essential definition and definition by cause. And you rarely get there, but you can hardly do better than that.
We might get into this later, but let me close maybe our first segment here on definition by asking, how do we agree on definition, and what happens when we disagree on definition?
That's a great question, Scott. You know, so a great and difficult question. So I think that, right, there are many things that hopefully we can come to agreement on, you know, where maybe we can find the definition of tree or dog or perhaps human being, something like that. And the reason for that is that those are naturally existing things, right? They're not artifacts, mm-hmm. and they're also simple, right? It's a species. It's not as complicated as defining classical education or humanism or conservatism or something. But I think if we begin with the strategies that can help us with those things that maybe are easier to come to agreement about, then we've got the strategies to at least speak clearly about the more complex things where we either, right, realize that we don't agree with someone else and we kind of have stipulated alternative ways of thinking about something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can then just dialogue about that rather than talking past each other, assuming a different definition of a word. But it doesn't mean that with all this, we'll just, you know, have, you know, paint by definition.
Sure.
It's easy. Yeah.
But it helps to have clarity.
Exactly.
On
right.
Both sides.
Yeah.
Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education here at Hillsdale College, as we begin our occasional series on definition. Dr. Beyer, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to John J. Miller, head of the Dow Journalism Department at Hillsdale College. He talked with us about Frederick Douglass, the journalist. Charles Kessler, his new book, Crisis of the Two Constitutions, The Rise, Decline, and Recovery of American Greatness. And finally, Ben Beyer from Hillsdale's Education Department, beginning his occasional series on definition. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere Ag and Turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Slow down.
Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
Some things in life you can just rely on, like the comfy fit of a favorite pair of jeans and the tried and true performance of a new home comfort system from Rood. So here's to reliability built into everything we do. Rely on Rood.
Get reliable comfort when the weather turns cold with a new heating system installed by the local pros at Alliance Heating and Air. Call Alliance Heating and Air today at 530-221-2642.
Wherever the art of medicine is loved, there is also a love of humanity. Hippocrates.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Joining us today is Lorraine Woodworth, a nurse. Welcome, Lorraine.
How do you do? Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
All right. I am a registered nurse, and I started in the 90s in Reading. And for some very odd reason, I've always been fascinated with surgical procedures that alter are functions in some way that have to be adapted, and wounds and things that a lot of people may not be particularly interested in, but it's always fascinated me. So after I finished my bachelor's degree at Chico State, I went on to get a certification in wounds, ostomies, and continence. So that's my area that I function in, and now I'm a hospice nurse. That's kind of the way I've done. I'm semi-retired, but I still do work.
So in a lot of popular media, there's this certain idea of what a nurse is. You know, people will picture the TV shows. How much of that would you say is true?
Well, nursing is one of those most highly respected professions. Statistically, when they do tests or surveys of who you trust, who you don't trust, there are people who will trust their nurse over their doctor. The best nurses, I think, are people who really love the science of it, the interaction with human beings, and the ability to help people. And those that are just punching the clock for a job, well, you know, they're in every line of work, even your doctors and people like that.
So there's this idea that all nurses are kind, gentle, loving, caring kind of characters who are very sensitive souls. Do you find that
no.
to be accurate?
Anybody that knows me knows that's not true. I'm sorry. No, not every nurse is. No, not every human being is. It's a tremendous cross-section of humanity is in the nursing profession.
I feel like it would be a lot like police work or fire work of sometimes they start out being bright and hopeful, but over time with all of the things they deal with, they get a little jaded when it comes to optimism in the world.
Well, a lot of that depends on what area of nursing you're in. In my own personal experience, and that's all I have to go by, people that work in emergency, those are the people that are going to see all kinds of negative aspects of humanity. People that work in surgical floors, you know, they deal with medical doctors and post-operative. Everybody has a different job. I think that some people have a gallows type of humor, and they'll see funny in things that other people would shiver at. But I don't think it's intended to be mean or nasty. It's just you have to in some way protect yourself from some of the things that you see. But I've never met a nurse that's deliberately mean or is totally indifferent to the suffering of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they'd last very long.
So I didn't realize before, and I feel terrible about this now, that there are different kinds of nurses in one hospital.
So let's take the emergency room, for instance. Those nurses are at a specific level of emergency, just stop bleeding, restore breathing. This is what we need to do right immediately. On another floor that we call med-surg, a medical unit, people come in being sick, or they just had surgery and they're having a rather normal recovery or an expected recovery. But that nurse will be specially experienced in taking care of antibiotics and hanging the medicines and watching for reactions to the medicines, looking for infections in the wound, making sure that whatever was sewn up stays sewn up, all those kinds of things. In an ortho floor, an orthopedic surgery floor, you have to know about all kinds of different equipment that people come in with, tractions, and they're all hung differently with things to keep a leg that's been broken in place. I mean, every single floor in a hospital has a specific type of patient that they're dealing with. And then, you know, like you get a person like me, for instance, when I worked in the hospital, if I was working as a wound and ostomy nurse, ostomy means opening external mouth to outside the body, and the word before that or the preface is whatever part of the body has been made into an ostomy.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the person that needs to be fitted with the appliance, and for it to work, you have to educate them. Or if they have a wound, you just do rounds all day with people that have wounds and come up with treatment plans for them. So there's dialysis nurses, nurses that specialize in kidney dialysis. That's a very specific skill and job. I mean, those are just a few of the things
mm-hmm.
that different nurses are skilled and trained.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.